Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Fiction. Science fiction. Horror. Fantasy. Crime. LGBT. Thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCB 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 105.0 AM Palm Springs.
We're going to be talking about Winston Churchill and a book, Walk with Destiny, and that's Churchill by Andrew Roberts, and we have the author with us. So thank you for taking the time.
Thank you very much indeed. Actually, it's called Walking with Destiny. It's a quotation from the last paragraph of the first of his war memoirs.
Oh, excellent. I'll make a note of it. So, now, this is he's quite a figure in history and has had quite a life. Let's start, first of all, where was he born? And he's half American, half British, right?
That's right, yes. He's born in Blenheim Palace, of the non-royal palaces in this country, and he was the son of Lord Randolph Churchill, who was himself the son of the Duke of Marlborough. So he started off life very much born to the purple. He was about as grand as it gets in Victorian society when the aristocracy were at the apex of that society. His mother was born in Brooklyn. She was a great beauty and a socialite in Victorian England. And a very glamorous family.
So now, so if he was born and raised with a good family, so to speak, with money, but he still chose to go into he joined the army or something, didn't he? Wasn't he in military?
Yes. Well, actually, although they did have a certain degree of money, they were huge spendthrifts. His parents, pretty much money when his father died. In 1895, when his father was 45 and he was 20. And so, in fact, he was forced to become a war correspondent. He became the best-paid war correspondent in the world at one point. And he also was forced to write lots of books as well, which is a very good thing as far as an historian is concerned, because we can understand so much about him through his writing.
Now, he was responsible for writing his own speeches, wasn't he?
Yes, that's right. He dictated them to secretaries who took down in shorthand, and then he checked them and practiced them endlessly and would put an enormous amount of time and effort and thought into his speeches. But he never used a speechwriter. He equally never used a spin doctor. He never took any notice of opinion polls or focus groups. When Churchill said something, you knew that it came directly from him.
Yeah, he spoke right from the heart then. He was able to make it a good speech, but...
Wonderful speech. 8,000 pages of speeches. In fact, 5.1 million words he spoke in public in his career, and he spoke... He had a sixth sense, really, for audiences. He was tremendously good at sizing up what would work with each particular audience.
So when we talk about his personality, we hear a lot, there's a lot of rumors and stories and stuff. Was he really someone that cried a lot?
Yes, he burst into tears on a very regular basis. It's surprising. One thinks of him as a buttoned-up Victorian aristocrat, because that's very much of his age and class and background, but in fact he wasn't at all. He was a much more romantic sort of regency figure, driven by his passions and his emotions. And during the Second World War, he burst into tears no fewer than 50 times. And so it must have been rather off-putting, you know, to have the Prime Minister crying. But people recognised that he was a somebody who didn't be a British stiff upper lip kind of attitude.
Hmm. So now, but he was quite a drinker, wasn't he?
Yes. He was indeed, but he wasn't an alcoholic. He was able to. He had an iron constitution. He was able to deal with alcohol to an extraordinary degree. In fact, there was a friend of his, the journalist C.P. Scott, who said Winston Churchill couldn't have been an alcoholic because no alcoholic could have drunk that much. And that's very much the case. There's only one occasion in the full 2,194 days of the Second World War that that the people around Churchill believed that he was drunk.
Mm. So now, what brought him into politics? Like, how did he get into being in Parliament?
Well, he always wanted to be in Parliament. He wanted to vindicate the memory of his father. And the reason that he actually went into the army was to make a name for himself and get into Parliament after having won medals and proved his gallantry, because he didn't have the money to buy a constituency seat in the same way that that some of the richer families in Britain were able to do that in those days.
So now, he ran as a Conservative.
Started... on the liberal side of the Conservative Party. He inherited from his father a belief in what was called Tory democracy, which came from the Prime Minister Benjamin Disraeli, which was a very sort of liberal form of conservatism. Yeah.
He voted quite a bit for the Liberals. How did he become Prime Minister? Like, what was the thing that made him Prime Minister?
Well, he crossed the floor of the House not once but twice. He became a Liberal and then got back after 20 years to being a Conservative again. So he was quite mistrusted. His judgment was mistrusted because he also made lots of errors in his life. It was he made mistake after mistake. In fact, he told his wife, Clementine, I should have made nothing if I had not made mistakes. And his whole career was full of most extraordinary reversals and ups and downs. But in the 1930s, for various reasons, first British politician, certainly the first major politician, to warn against Adolf Hitler and the Nazis and to point out how important it was that we rearmed, especially in the air and to a lesser but equally important degree, really, in the Navy and the Army. And nobody took any notice of him. And he spent an entire decade warning again and again, and even though he showed tremendous moral courage... he was finally allowed to become Prime Minister and start the fight back.
Wow. You know, when he became Prime Minister, he made some of his best speeches. That recent movie that came out about him, how did you find the portrayal?
I liked it very much, yes. I thought Gary Oldman did a wonderful job in portraying Winston Churchill. He caught, of course, he was helped enormously by the prosthetics that he was wearing, which made him look exactly like Churchill. But he was also able to catch the sort of twinkle in the eye and the humour of Winston Churchill, which I thought was excellent. There have been some very negative portrayals of Churchill recently, but this one was a affectionate one, I thought.
Yeah, you know, I was going to mention that. The negative portrayals or the some of the negative things I've heard, like people seem to protest somewhat against using him as a good man. What do you think that's all about?
Well, I think some of this is perfectly reasonable because, as I mentioned, he did make terrible mistakes in his life. He was on the wrong side of the debate over women's suffrage, for example. He wanted India not to have its independence, at least in the 1930s. He was opposed to he took Britain back onto the gold standard at the wrong rate at the wrong time. But these are actually fairly, and also he very badly mishandled the Dardanelles campaign from World War One, which led to a lot of slaughter on the out in the Gallipoli Peninsula. But compared to the things that he got right, the really huge things that he got right, I don't think these matter terribly. They don't. They're not overwhelming the balance by any means.
Yeah, I just wonder because I think that I just wonder if it's just getting caught up in like in the States how they're taking down all the Southern leaders and stuff like that. It seems to be awfully aggressive, and he was really a person of his time. So we kind of have to accept what the time was and how people were.
Oh, totally. With regard to race, he did believe in a hierarchy of races, which, of course, seems ludicrous and obscene to us now. But nonetheless, back in those days, when he was born, Charles Darwin was still alive, and people thought of racial hierarchy as a scientific theory that had been proved. So it's very harsh, I think, to try to judge people in the 21st century, if they were born in the 19th century, where completely different attitudes towards what was true scientifically were prevalent.
So how do you think his popularity was during the war? I guess he was pretty high, wasn't he?
It was extraordinary. He broke all records. He was easily the most popular prime minister we've had before or since. The Gallup polls that they took regularly through the pretty much throughout the war, had him in the high 80s, early 90s as a percentage of popularity, which is truly extraordinary.
After the war, why did he leave being prime minister?
Well, he lost the election. Despite his enormous personal popularity, the Conservative Party that he led were profoundly unpopular, not least because of the way that they had supported appeasement before the war. And people were tired of war. After 6 years, they wanted to have the welfare state and all the various things, the nationalisation and so on, that the Labour Party and the Socialists offered. And Churchill was only one name on 650, on one ballot out of the 650 members of Parliament. So although he was returned, not many other Conservatives were.
Now, he came back for a second term, didn't he, later?
He did, yes, between October 1951 and April 1955. And during that term, he built a million council houses in places that, of course, the original ones had been destroyed in the war. And he got rid of rationing, which was still in existence even 6 years after the end of the Second World War, and various other achievements like that.
Wow. So, now, he only had one wife, is that true?
Oh, yes, absolutely. He married Clementine when he was a young man, and they had an extremely happy marriage. And he took advice from her, not on technical matters or military matters, but on the sort of wider and broader political matters of who he could trust and who he should be loyal to and so on. And she gave him very good advice, really, all the way through his life.
So he was pretty anti-Hitler. And what was his relationship with Russia like?
It changed. It changed many times. The time of the Russian Revolution, he was very, very anti-Bolshevik, anti-communist. Then in the when Hitler was rampant in the late 1930s, he wanted to have an alliance with Russia to try and stop Hitler. Then when Stalin had his Nazi-Soviet pact with Hitler, he became very anti-Russian again. Then 3 years later, when Hitler invaded Russia, he became pro-Russian. Then at the end of the Second World War, when he saw that Stalin and the Soviets posed a serious threat to the balance of power in Europe, he became very anti-Russian. And then after the Soviets exploded their first nuclear device testing successfully in 1949, he became not pro-Russian, but pro an agreement with Russia that would ensure that there was no nuclear war. So he changed his views, changed his stance over Russia many times. But on each occasion, he was in fact putting the British national interests first.
And in that movie, they kind of portrayed him as having kind of, it was a mixed relationship with FDR. Like he was trying to get him to come into the war, but he wouldn't. What was his relationship like with FDR?
It was a close personal relationship. They both came from the sort of aristocracies of their own countries. He liked him personally. They got on well. They appreciated each other's sense of humor and so on. But you're right. He became increasingly disappointed, really, that the United States wasn't getting more involved in World War II, and in fact that it ultimately, in terms of the European sphere at least, it took Adolf Hitler to declare war on America on the 11th of December 1941, when he believed that Churchill believed that the war was won for civilization and democracy, and was hoping therefore that the United States would get much more involved much earlier. And one of the things that I've been very fortunate in this book to be able to use lots of new sources that have never been used before for a biography of Churchill. And one of them was that the Queen allowed me to be the first Churchill biographer to use her father's diaries. And Churchill met King George VI every Tuesday of the war, and the King wrote down everything Churchill said. And one of the things that struck me most seriously, really, was was the level of sheer frustration that Churchill had that the Roosevelt administration wasn't getting America more involved.
Yeah, and they sort of had to get into it eventually with Japan and everything.
You had to get involved in the Pacific. There wasn't that the same impetus really in the on the Atlantic side, on the European side, because there was no great direct threat that you were under. And so I think still it was one of the great acts of statesmanship of the 20th century that the Roosevelt administration put Germany first before dealing with Japan.
Yeah. It's kind of amazing. Now, I hear a lot when we do a lot of history shows. Now, the Americans were still supplying a lot of supplies to the Great Britain, but they were also doing that for Germany as well, weren't they?
No, they weren't. They gave them, they sold Britain a quarter of a million rifles in 1940, which was a tremendously helpful and useful for us, especially as we were under daily threat of invasion at that time. And then after May 1941, when you signed the Lend-Lease agreements, and those were passed in Congress, Britain was able to buy much more war material and not pay in gold immediately, which was also very, very helpful for Britain. But no, your manufacturers were not supplying the Nazis.
Okay. Yeah, you know, there's a lot of revisionists. There's a lot of conspiracy theories out nowadays, it seems like.
You say that again. There's a new one every day. It was quite extraordinary, especially about Churchill. For some reason, there are a lot. I see the ones that say that Churchill was responsible for. The recent one was sinking the Titanic.
Oh.
It's completely absurd in every possible way, but nonetheless, it doesn't stop with the internet. In the cyberspace, you get all sorts of completely ridiculous things being argued.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy because it gets hard to you have to read something and then you have to always double check. You know, you just can't take it on face value anymore.
No, not at all. And actually, I came across one the other day which has been around for a very long time, saying that Churchill wanted to use gas against the Iraqi tribes in the 1920s. And so I went to Churchill College, Cambridge, to try and pin down the truth about this. When you read the letter that he sent as war minister, he talks of lacrimatory gas, which is tear gas, an entirely different kind of gas, of course, from the phosgene or the mustard gas that killed people. This was just simply intended to make them cry, like you use against rioters in Western cities today.
Hmm. It's crazy. How did Churchill deal with Edward VIII and his abdication and Mrs. Simpson? Like, what did he get involved in that?
He did, yes, to a disastrous degree, actually, for his career. He supported Edward VIII. He didn't see why he couldn't marry Mrs. Simpson. He thought that it was a love match and it was perfectly reasonable and that the king should not lose his throne just simply because he wanted to marry an American divorcee. And so he set himself very much against the sort of overarching morality of the time, which said that this couldn't happen, especially the Church of England was profoundly against it, as was the Cabinet and the Times newspaper and the rest of the royal family and so on, the establishment. And so he actually got shouted down in the House of Commons in December 1936 when he tried to put his point of view.
Hmm. So now, another one that there was that recent movie about the King Kama and Ruth Williams being married and stuff like that. Now, how have you seen the movie and how accurate do you find it?
I'm so sorry. Ruth Williams? Which movie was it?
She was the UK office worker that married the future king. Of an African country?
I'm afraid I missed that one.
Oh, okay. Well, they sort of implied, I guess, that because she was white and British, she should never marry a African. And then she went down there to live, and then they brought him back, and I guess they kept him away from the country for quite a while. That's kind of how they portrayed it.
It doesn't ring any bells with Winston Churchill's career that I know of, but I'm afraid I didn't watch the show.
No, well, that's all right. It's all right. What were the biggest surprises you find out about Churchill that when you're doing your research that you were just totally shocked by?
Well, I was very, very surprised by this this attitude towards America, because, of course, in public he wasn't able to criticize the United States, let alone the Roosevelt administration at all. In 1940 or 1941, especially over things like the disposition of the American fleet at Pearl Harbor, for example. But when he was talking to the king privately, he did make these various criticisms, and so that was quite a surprise to me. I was very lucky, really, to be able to be the first Churchill biographer to use the king's diaries, because they proved to be an absolute cornucopia of new things. And we also I was very lucky that there was 41 sets of papers of people who've worked with Churchill that have become available over the last 10 years. The diaries of Ivan Maisky, the Russian ambassador, made by eyebrows go up a lot. The extent to which Churchill was willing to get in bed with the Russians in order to try to stop Hitler. The whole area of the debates going on in the War Cabinet, I managed to find the verbatim accounts of the War Cabinet meetings, which had never been discovered before. So that, too, was tremendously helpful. And there's something, therefore, on pretty much every page of my book, which has not appeared in a Churchill biography before, which is pretty astonishing, considering there have been no fewer than 1,009 Churchill biographies published.
Yeah, that's amazing. When you were also doing research on Churchill, is there information out there now that people believe on Churchill that isn't true? That's fairly mainstream.
Oh, hundreds of things. Absolutely hundreds of things. Yes, he's.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Blame for all sorts of things that he wasn't responsible for. Most recently, there's been an attempt to accuse him of being a war criminal because of the Bengal famine in 1943, where an awful lot of Indians died of starvation in Bengal because we weren't able to get rice from various parts of the of Asia that the Japanese controlled, and this has been put down to Churchill completely unfairly. He's been accused of pretty much everything. I saw the other day there was a headline on one blog saying Churchill was a non-smoker. Which, considering he smoked 160,000 cigars in his life, and of which there is ample photographic evidence, that's just the latest, really.
Oh, and there's the one about him wearing his pajamas all the time in Parliament and stuff like that.
I hadn't heard that.
Yeah,
that's a new one. I mean, he did have a nap in the afternoon every afternoon for an hour. Because he believed that it extended his working day and that he'd therefore be able to stay up much later. And he didn't stop working until 2 o'clock in the morning most evenings of the Second World War. So I think he might have been right about that. But he absolutely never appeared in the House of Commons in his pajamas.
Yeah. Well, you know, there's all sorts of stuff, like I said. You just...
Yeah.
It's so
tough. The thing to do, really, is just to keep calm and to go back to the original sources and to see the truth. And actually, his dress sense was pretty eccentric. He created a sort of what was called a siren suit, which is rather like a boiler suit made of velvet that he used to wear, but never in the House of Commons. He wore zip-up shoes because he thought it saved him time. He was quite an eccentric in that regard, but he also did know how to behave in a dignified way when it came to the dress code for the Houses of Parliament.
Now, what's your thought on the whole India thing and the colonization and stuff and the way Churchill handled it? What position do you take on that?
Well, Churchill, of course, when he started off as a young subaltern in India in the late 1890s, fell in love with the British Empire. He saw aspects of the British Empire as being the highest point of British civilization, in that it was a deliberate attempt to help the native peoples of India. It had doubled the life expectancy in India. It had brought the amount of land under cultivation in India up to 8 times what it had been before the British arrived. It abolished appalling practices like sati, a practice of throwing a live widow onto her late husband's funeral pyre. We didn't allow any of that to continue. Also, we created the railway system, first universities, the English language, handed on Western democracy, and various other aspects of the world, the more developed modern world that has stood India in very good stead in its years since independence. So Winston Churchill believed that that was something worth defending. And again, you have to see these beliefs in the context of their times.
Right, of course. So how is this relationship with France? That's another big, hit and miss with UK and France.
Yeah, well, he was a great Francophile. He liked the French. He spoke execrable French himself, but used to make jokes about how bad his French was. But nonetheless, he was he visited France an awful lot in his life, and he was all in favor of the alliance with France. But, of course, in the First World War. But when in the Second World War the French signed an armistice with Hitler and effectively surrendered, he knew that the French fleet, if it fell into the hands of the Nazis, would be used against Britain and might well be involved in attempting to invade Britain. So he sank a good deal of it at Oran in North Africa in July 1940, which, as one can understand from the French point of view, made him tremendously unpopular. But frankly, it was a desperate measure that, in my view, needed to be taken in order to protect the British Isles themselves.
Now, how long do you think the war would have lasted if the States had not got involved and Japan didn't get involved as quickly?
Well, we might well have lost it, of course. I mean, I don't know how long it would have lasted, because we weren't... after the Battle of Britain had been won, Hitler wasn't able to invade Britain. But he was building up an enormous force of U-boats. He had, at the end of the war, 463 operational U-boats, which could have starved Britain. And Britain, of course, desperately was buying food from the United States. If the United States didn't sell it, then we might well have had mass starvation in this country. Also, if the United States hadn't got involved and helped the Russians, it might have taken much longer for the Russians to win the war in the East. And maybe they even wouldn't have won it at all. It's perfectly possible. So, So, yes, American intervention was absolute precondition for victory of the Second World War.
Do you think Hitler was surprised by how much America contributed to the war?
Yes. Oh, absolutely. He. It's extraordinary that he declared war on you, really, because America was an uninvadable country. He had no senior Nazi had even been to America apart from Joachim von Ribbentrop, who went to New York for a few months in the 1920s to sell champagne. But other than that, none of them knew anything about America. And yet, by the calendar year 1944, when Britain produced 28,000 warplanes and Russia and Germany each produced 40,000, the United States produced 98,000 warplanes, almost the same as the whole of the rest of the world put together. And that was something that if Hitler had been better informed about the United States, he'd have realized that it was unwinnable.
Yeah, I think Hitler at that time probably thought he was undefeatable, you know.
Yes, he did, and he also wildly underestimated. He had no sense of American society either, or the way in which once America decided to industrialize in a military way, it was able to churn out Liberty ships and the most extraordinary amount of material. It put 16 men and women into uniform. I mean, these were numbers that the Third Reich just had no way of dealing with by 1942.
What's your thoughts on all that? All the shows and people that are directed toward Hitler being still or Hitler living and not killing himself and making it to Argentina and all the different stuff like that.
Well, again, conspiracy theories are rampant and riot about these things. You see a lot of them, actually, especially the ones to do with Hitler sort of somehow surviving the ruins of the Reichschancellery in April 1945, actually were KGB propaganda in the post-war period, which were they were deliberately put about in order to destabilize Germany, to keep people still worried about the Nazis, and to generally cause disruption and misinformation in the West.
Oh, yeah. No, I sort of agree, but it's just that it's making mainstream. They're showing, you know, hunting Hitler on History Channel, you know.
I know. Well, there are an awful lot of things on the History Channel that basically should be on the same channel as you know, aliens and all of those kinds of things.
Yeah, they're not like they used to be. History and Discovery used to be very educational. You could learn things, but now it's very entertainment prone. I think
entertainment. Yes, exactly. Ice truckers and all of that kind of thing. I don't see that ice truckers should necessarily be on either of those information channels, at least.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy. How did Churchill end up dying eventually? Like, what took him away?
Well, actually, he lived until he was 90. Even though he'd smoked 160,000 cigars and drank a great deal of brandy and champagne in his life, he had this iron constitution, as I mentioned, and he died very peacefully in his bed at home in London, surrounded by his children and grandchildren, at the age of 90 in January 1965.
Wow. And I could imagine the funeral must have been pretty massive.
It was. I'm sadly only 2 years old at the time of the funeral, but it was one of the very great occasions in British history. He wanted lots of music, lots of bands, and there were nine in all. There was a great procession from the Houses of Parliament to St. Paul's Cathedral, where he was buried. The heads of state and heads of government of scores of countries came to Britain. Her Majesty the Queen, who doesn't go to funerals, attended this one. And the body was then taken down the River Thames and buried at Bladen, the small churchyard just outside Blenheim Palace. And it was one of those moments where, as I mentioned several times in my book, Walking with Destiny, right at the end, it was one of those times that many commentators saw as being the end of British greatness.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. What do you think the biggest impact that his life will have on us in now generations?
Well, I think, of course, they're still living in the post-war period in a way. You know, the fact that civilization did manage to defeat the great evil of Nazism is something that should still be celebrated. I think his life has many lessons for leadership of today. His moral courage, his physical courage, his ability to learn from his many mistakes. I think his sense of foresight is tremendously important, and his eloquence. You put all of those together, and you have somebody who really did help save civilization.
And when you talk about moral courage, was there any particular scandals that were set around Churchill?
Scandals? Well, there are some that brought down various friends of his. There were financial scandals that dogged three or four of the senior members of the Liberal coalition before the First World War. And then one or two during the Second World War that forced the resignations of friends of his. But as far as personal scandals, you know, he wasn't. I mean, he was totally sexually faithful to the wife Clementine, who he loved. He was always broke all the time. But he was one of those people who believed that when you didn't have any money, the best thing to do was to work harder. Rather than to cut back, and so there are no scandals there either, and he's pretty much scandal free as a politician.
You know, I see quite a bit with the politics today and leaders. A lot of people use Churchill or FDR or Kennedy as kind of a threshold or a line that they compare themselves with. And they mentioned something that they might have said, these leaders. Do you think he's really got influence over any of the leaders today, or there's any leaders that were kind of similar to him that you've noticed?
I think he does, in fact, actually. Yes, I think that people do read about him. You know, people who are interested in going into politics and who are already in politics do read about him. I know that he had a tremendous influence on the political views of Margaret Thatcher, for example, who also tried to emulate his moral courage. And I think when people read about him, which they do in enormous numbers, this book, Walking with Destiny, has sold 150,000 copies already, only after a couple of months of publication. And so there obviously is a great sense of interest in him, and I think that must be connected in some way to his leadership and the quality of leadership. And so there are lots of lessons, I think, that can be learned for the present day from the example of such an extraordinary man.
I think one thing that I noticed is if you look at him, he was also very political savvy as well. And I think a lot of people don't realize that.
No, that's right. That's a very good point. He, you don't get to the top and stay at the top of politics for a very long period unless you have a sense of what will go down with the public and what won't. And so he certainly, I mean, for example, after getting back into power in 1951, he didn't start to dismantle the welfare state, even though he hadn't agreed with every aspect of it by any means. He had enough political nous to know what the British people would put up with and what they wouldn't. So I think you're right. It's one mustn't just think of Churchill as being a sort of mad maverick who stuck to his guns and was proved right. he was actually a much more subtle, much more complex, much more intellectual figure than that.
And did he have a good relationship with the royal family in all, or?
Well, he didn't start off well, certainly. King George V thought of him as an untrustworthy firebrand with bad judgments. King George VI, especially at the time of the abdication crisis, when he had, of course, supported his elder brother, also distrusted his judgment and, in fact, told the Prime Minister of Canada that he would not appoint Winston Churchill Prime Minister under any other circumstances than a world war. And then, of course, we did get a world war. and those were the circumstances in which he was appointed, at which point the whole thing changed. And during the Battle of Britain and the Blitz, the King and Churchill made firm friends. In fact, in those diaries that I mentioned, he refers to Churchill as his friend, and he became the only one of the King's four prime ministers to whom he referred by his Christian name. So it was a very much a close relationship. And then he had another great relationship with the present Queen, who he rather worshipped and thought was wonderful. And so, what started off as a pretty rocky relationship with the House of Windsor actually turned into fast friendship.
What started it so rough? Like, what was the problem that they sort of saw in Churchill at the beginning?
Well, appeasement really was. This wasn't the beginning, because it actually goes back to the period before appeasement, when they just thought he had no judgment, crossing the floor of the House of Commons not once but twice. It's something very few politicians had ever done before or since, and the royal family thought that was the mark of a maverick. But by the 1930s, the royal family were very much committed to Neville Chamberlain's policy of appeasing Adolf Hitler in the hope that would lessen Hitler's demands and prevent another catastrophic war breaking out. And so when Churchill instead said that we needed to rearm as much as possible, and that Hitler couldn't be trusted and we shouldn't give anything to him, it was considered by many in the royal family to be yet another example of his misjudgment.
What do you think, how do you think he would do or be in a world of today?
I think he'd be very good, actually, at tweeting. I think he'd be excellent. Many of his best riposts and witticisms do fit into 280 characters or fewer. He was very good at the radio when that came online. And every politician in every era has to try to command the latest forms of communication and make them work for them. And I think Churchill would have been absolutely fine at doing that. There's a great joke which also would have fitted onto a tweet that Churchill made when his cook said that his private secretary Jock Colville said that their cook had been made pregnant as a result of a nocturnal assignation with a man in the street in Verona, and Churchill immediately replied, "Obviously not one of the two gentlemen."
Yeah, he'd be in a Twitter war with Trump. Well, I just wonder what people of that generation in that world during the war, and how hard people in the 40s fought to stay alive and to keep, you know, the empire together and the country, would feel about the way nationalism is and all of the problems that we've got going on and Brexit even and stuff like that, or even joining the Union. Would he have even supported that, you know?
I don't think he'd have supported joining the European Union at all, no. He, or at least Britain joining it. He was very much in favour of there being a common market. He was a leader of the European movement, and he made great speeches in the late 1940s supporting the idea, as he said, that Teuton must never fight Gaul, i.e. the French and Germans must never go to war with one another, because, of course, the last two times they'd done it, they'd nearly ripped the continent apart, and had led to the death, of course, of very many of Churchill's closest friends. So he was in favour of there being a European Union, but actually when you look at his speeches, he never advocated Britain joining it. And in fact, when he was Prime Minister in the latter part, the second of his premierships, the 1951 to 55 one, which of course was only 2 years preceded the Treaty of Rome that brought Europe into being in 1957, he did absolutely nothing to promote Britain getting involved. He kept us out of the Iron and Steel Confederation, he kept us out of the European Army, and he wrote minutes saying that what mattered to Britain really was the Commonwealth and the links with the United States, the special relationship.
Yeah, pretty amazing. So having a successful book, Historial, how do you feel? How does it make you feel?
It truly is the most wonderful feeling in the world. I've been writing history books for 30 years. Some of them have been so... they've won prizes, which is very nice, but some of them have sold so few copies that I think I've personally met every single one of the readers of some of my books.
Yeah.
And so it's tremendous to... I'm about to embark on a five-state, 50-speech book tour of the United States. And it's something I've always wanted to do, and I'm tremendously excited. And it really is the best feeling in the world to be. I've been on the New York Times bestseller list for 8 weeks now, and it's the most tremendously exciting and thrilling period of my life, really.
Yeah, pretty amazing, but an incredible book. Now, do you have a website or anything that if people want to contribute or get a hold of you or anything like that?
Yeah, absolutely. No, I do. It's www.andrew-roberts.net. They can read the reviews of the book and various other bits of information about the book. And of course, it's also got a link through to Amazon.
Yeah, the new book club of the world now, hey?
Yes, yes. Well, I mean, people should go to their independent book stores, of course. Under no circumstances, that would really be the best thing for the long-term future of literature.
Yeah, yeah. Well, again, this has been a very, very interesting show, and we've been talking with the author of Walking with Destiny, and that's Winston Churchill, and... Andrew Roberts, thank you very much.
You are kind. Thank you very much indeed.
To find out more about our show, guests, or to listen to past shows from our archive, please go to www.houseofmysteryradio.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.